of Scarlet being pulled out into space. "Cinder, the pod ship," said Aiko. "She's taking the pod ship! Two life forms aboard!"
"What?"
Cinder looked up at the panel. Sure enough, the room's scanners indicated there was only one shuttle still docked. The Thaumaturge had survived, and she'd taken Scarlet with her. Chapter 11.
"She has Scarlet," said Cinder. "Quick, close the hatch. I'll take the other pod. I'll follow them."
Her words faltered, her brain catching up. She did not know how to fly a pod ship, but she could figure it out. She could download some instructions and
she would have to.
"Your friend is dying."
She spun around. She'd forgotten about the Lunar Guard. He was pressing a hand to his side, where Cinder's projectile was still embedded, but his attention was on Wolf. Wolf, who was unconscious and surrounded by blood.
"Oh no, oh no."
She ejected the knife in her finger and started cutting the blood-stained fabric away from Wolf's wounds.
"Thorn, we need to get Thorn. Then we can go after Scarlet and I'll bandage Wolf and—"
She glanced at the guard.
"Shirt,"
she said firmly, although the order was more to focus her own thoughts. In seconds, the guard's hands were working at her command, removing the empty gun holster and pulling his own bloodied shirt over his head. She was glad to see a second undershirt as well. She had a feeling they were going to need every bit of bandaging she could find to stanch Wolf's bleeding. Eventually, they would have to get him to the medbay, but there was no way she could move him in this condition, especially not up that ladder. She tried to ignore the niggling thought in her head that this was not enough, that not even the bandages in the medbay would be enough. She grabbed the guard's shirt and bunched it against Wolf's chest. At least this bullet had missed his heart. She hoped the other one hadn't hit anything vital either. Her thoughts were hazy, repeating over and over in her head. They had to get Thorn. They had to go after Scarlet. They had to save Wolf. She couldn't do it all. She couldn't do any of it.
"Thorn,"
her voice broke.
"Where's Thorn?"
Keeping one hand pressed onto Wolf's wound, she reached for the guard with the other, grabbing his collar and pulling him toward her.
"What did you do to Thorn?"
"Your friend who boarded the satellite," he said, as much a statement as a question.
There was regret in his face, but not enough.
"He's dead."
She shrieked and slammed him into the wall.
"You're lying!"
He flinched, but didn't try to protect himself. Even though she'd already lost her focus, she could not keep him under her control so long as her thoughts were so divided, so long as this chaos and devastation reigned in her head.
"Mr. Sybil changed the satellite's trajectory, removing it from orbit. It will burn up during entry. It probably already has. There's nothing you can do."
"No,"
she said, shaking her head. Every part of her was trembling.
"She wouldn't have sacrificed her own programmer, too."
But there was no telltale orange light in her vision. He wasn't lying. The guard leaned his head back as his gaze skimmed Cinder from head to toe, as if examining an unusual specimen.
"She would sacrifice anyone to get to you. The Queen seems to believe you're a threat."
Cinder ground her teeth so hard, she felt that her jaw would snap from the pressure. There it was, stated with such blatant simplicity. This was her fault. This was all her fault. They'd been after her.
"Your other shirt,"
she whispered. She didn't bother to control him this time, and he removed the undershirt without argument. Cinder grabbed it from him, spotting the end of her own projectile jutting from his skin, just below his ribs. Looking away, she pressed the second shirt against the wound in Wolf's back.
"Roll him onto his side."
"What?"
"Get him on his side. It'll open the airway. Help him breathe."
Cinder glowered at him, but a 4-second net search confirmed the validity of his suggestion, and she eased Wolf onto his side as gently as she could, positioning his legs like the medical diagram in her brain told her to. The guard didn't help, but he nodded approvingly when Cinder was done.
Cinder?
It was Aiko, her voice small and restrained. The ship had become dark, running only on emergency lighting and default systems. Aiko's anxiety was clouding her ability to function as much as Cinder's was.
What are we going to do?
Cinder struggled to breathe. A headache had burst open in her skull. The weight of everything pressed against her until it was almost too tempting to curl up over Wolf's body and simply give up. She couldn't help them. She couldn't save the world. She couldn't save anyone.
I don't know, she whispered. I don't know.
Finding someplace to hide would be a start, said the guard, followed by a ripping sound as he tore a shred of material from the hem of his pants. He winced as he yanked out the projectile and tossed it down the corridor before pressing the fabric against the wound. For the first time, she noticed that he still wore what looked like a large hunting knife sheathed on his belt. He looked up at her when she didn't respond, his eyes sharp as ice picks.
Maybe someplace your friend can get help?
As a thought. She shook her head.
I can't. We just lost both of our pilots and I can't fly. I don't know how.
I can fly.
But Scarlet.
Look, Thaumaturge Mira will be contacting Luna and sending for reinforcements, and the Queen's fleet isn't as far away as you might think. You're about to have an army on your trail.
But
nothing. You can't help that other girl. Consider her dead. But you might be able to help him.
Cinder dropped her chin, curling in on herself as the warring decisions in her head threatened to tear her apart. He was being logical. She recognized that. But it was so hard to admit defeat, to give up on Scarlet, to make that sacrifice and have to live with it. With every passing second, though, she was closer to losing Wolf, too. She glanced down. Wolf's face was scrunched in pain, his brow beaded with sweat.
Ship, said the guard. Calculate our location and relative trajectory over Earth. Where is the closest place we can get to? Someplace not too populated.
There was a hesitation before Aiko said,
Me?
He squinted up at the ceiling.
Yeah, you.
Sorry, right. Calculating now.
The lights brightened.
Following a natural descent to Earth, we could be in Central or North Africa in approximately 17 minutes. A loose 1,000-mile radius opens up to the Mediterranean regions of Europe and the western portion of the Eastern Commonwealth.
He needs a hospital,
Cinder murmured, knowing as she said it, there wasn't a hospital on Earth that wouldn't know he was one of the Queen's wolf hybrids as soon as he was admitted. And the risk she posed to take him there herself, and how recognizable the Rampian would be? Where could they possibly go that would offer them sanctuary? Nowhere was safe. Beneath her, Wolf moaned, his chest rattled. He needed a hospital, or a doctor.
Africa. Dr. Erland.
She peered up at the guard, and for the first time, struggled through the sluggish mess inside her head to wonder why he was doing this. Why hadn't he killed them all? Why was he helping them?
You serve the Queen, she said.
How can I trust you? His lips twitched, like she'd made a joke, but his eyes were quick to harden again.
I serve my princess, no one else.
The floor dropped out from beneath her.
The princess? His princess? He knew.
She waited a full breath of her lie detector to recognize his falsehood, but it didn't. He was telling the truth.
Africa, she said. Aiko, take us to Africa, to where the first outbreak of ledimosis occurred.
Chapter 12. The fall was slow at first. Gradual as the pull of the satellite's orbit was overpowered by the pull of Earth's gravity. Thorn hiked up his pant leg, using his toe to pry off his left boot. The knife he'd stashed there clattered onto the floor, and he grabbed for it, awkwardly trying to angle the blade toward the blanket that was knotted around his wrists. The girl murmured around her gag and shifted toward him. Her binds were much more secure and complex than his own. The thaumaturge had only bothered to have Thorn tie his hands in front of him. But this girl had binds all down her legs, in addition to having her wrists fastened behind her and the gag over her mouth. With no leverage to press the knife against his own binds, he nodded at the girl.
"Can you turn around?"
She flopped and rolled onto her side, pushing off the wall with her feet to turn herself so her hands were toward him. Thorn hunkered over her and sawed at the sheet that was cutting into her arms. By the time he'd hacked it off, there were deep red lines carved into her skin. She ripped the gag off her mouth, leaving it to hang around her neck, a knot of her frayed hair caught in the fabric.
"My feet!"
"Can you untie my hands?"
She said nothing as she snatched the knife from him. Her hands were shaking as she angled the blade toward the binds around her knees, and Thorn thought maybe it was best for her to practice on herself anyway. Sawing through the sheet, she looked like a madwoman, her brow wrinkled in concentration, her hair knotted, her complexion damp and blotchy, red lines drawn into her cheeks from the gag. But the adrenaline had her working quickly, and soon she was kicking away the material.
"My hands,"
Thorn said again, but she was already grasping for the sink and pulling herself up on trembling legs.
"I'm sorry, the entry procedures," she said, stumbling out into the main room.
Thorn grabbed the knife and clambered to his feet as the satellite took a sudden turn. He slipped, stumbling into the shower door. They were falling faster as Earth's gravity claimed them. Using the wall for balance, Thorn rushed into the main room. The girl had fallen too and was now scrambling to get over the bed.
"We need to get to the other pod ship and disconnect," said Thorn. "You need to untie me."
She shook her head and pressed herself against the wall where the smallest of the screens was embedded, the screen that the thaumaturge had meddled with before. Strings of hair were sticking to her face.
"She'll have a security block on the ship, and I know the satellite better, and oh no, no, no," she screamed, her fingers flying over the screen. "She changed the access code."
"What are you doing?"
"The entry procedures, the ablative coding should hold while we're passing through the atmosphere, but if I don't set the parachute to release, the whole thing will disintegrate on impact."
The satellite shifted again, and they both stumbled. Thorn fell onto the mattress, and the knife skittered out of his grip, bouncing off the end of the bed, while the girl tripped and landed on one knee. The walls around them began to tremble with the friction of Earth's atmosphere. The blackness that had clouded the small windows was replaced with a burning white light. The outer coating was burning off, protecting them from the atmosphere's heat. Unlike the Rampian, this satellite was designed for only one descent toward Earth.
"All right,"
forgetting about his binds, Thorn swung himself over to the other side of the bed and hauled the girl back to her feet.
"Get that parachute working."
She was still wobbly as he spun them toward the screen and dropped his arms over her, forming a cocoon around her body. She was even shorter than he'd realized, the top of her head not even reaching his collarbone. Her fingers jabbed at the screen as Thorn widened his stance and locked his knees, bracing himself as much as he could while the satellite shook and rocked around them. He hunched over her, trying to hold his balance and keep her steady while codes and commands flickered and scrolled across the screen. His attention flicked to the nearest window, still fiery white. As soon as the satellite had fallen far enough into Earth's atmosphere, the auto-gravity would shut off, and they would be as secure as dice in a gambler's fist.
"I'm in!"
she shouted. Thorn curled his toes of his one shoeless foot into the carpet. He heard a crash behind him and dared to glance back. One of the screens had fallen off the desk. He gulped. Anything not bolted down was about to turn into projectiles.
"How long will it take to—"
"Done!"
Thorn whipped her around and thrust them both toward the mattress.
"Under the bed!"
He stumbled and fell, dragging her down with him. The cabinet swung open overhead and Thorn flinched as a rain of canned goods and dishes clattered around them. He hunkered over the girl, deflecting them away from her.
"Quick!"
She scurried forward, out of the ring of his arms, and pulled herself into the shadows. She backed against the wall as far as she could, both hands pushing against the bed frame to lock her body in place. Thorn kicked off from the carpet and grabbed the nearest post to pull himself forward. The shaking stopped,
replaced with a smooth, fast descent. The brightness from the windows faded to a sunshine blue. Thorn's stomach swooped, and he felt like he was being sucked into a vacuum. He heard her scream. Pain and brightness exploded in his head, and then the world went black. Book 2. The witch snipped off her golden hair and cast her out into a great desert. Chapter 13. Cress would not have believed that she had the strength to drag Carswell Thorn beneath the bed and secure his unconscious body against the wall if the proof wasn't in her arms. All the while, cords and screens and plugs and dishes and food jostled and banged around them. The walls of the satellite groaned, and she squeezed her eyes shut, trying not to imagine the heat and friction melting through the bolts and seams, trying not to guess at how stable this untested satellite could be, trying not to think about plunging toward Earth, its mountains and oceans and glaciers and forests, and the impact that a satellite thrown from space would have when it crashed into the planet and shattered into billions of tiny pieces. She was doing a poor job of not imagining it all. The fall lasted forever, while her small world disintegrated. She'd failed. The parachute should have opened already. She should have felt it release, felt the snap back as it caught their descent and lowered them gently to Earth. But their fall was only faster and faster as the satellite's air grew warmer. Either she'd done something wrong, or the parachute hatch was faulty. Or perhaps there was no parachute at all, and the command was from false programming. After all, Sybil had commissioned this satellite. Surely she'd never intended to let Cress land safely on the blue planet. Sybil had succeeded. They were going to die. Cress wrapped her body around Carswell Thorn and buried her face into his hair. At least he would be unconscious through it all. At least he didn't have to be afraid. Then, a shudder, a sensation different from the drop. And she heard the brisk sound of nylon ropes and hissing. And there it was, the sudden jerk that seemed to pull them back into the sky. She cried out and gripped Carswell Thorn tighter as her shoulder smacked into the underside of the bed. The fall became a sinking, and Cress's sobs turned to relief. She squeezed Thorn's prone body and sobbed and hyperventilated and sobbed some more. It took ages for the impact to come, and when it did, the jolt knocked Cress into the bed again. The satellite crashed and slid, rolled over and tumbled. They were slipping down something solid, perhaps a hill or mountainside. Cress clenched her teeth against a scream and tried to protect Thorn with one arm while bracing them against the wall with the other. She'd expected water. So much of the Earth's surface was water, not this solid something they'd hit. The spiraling descent finally halted with a crash that shook the walls around them. Cress's lungs burned with the effort to take in what air they could. Every muscle ached from adrenaline and the strain of bracing for impact and the battering her body had taken. But in her head, the pain was non-existent. They were alive. They were on Earth, and they were alive. A grateful, shocked cry fell out of her, and she embraced Thorn, crying happily into the crook of his neck. But the joy receded when he did not hold her back. She'd almost forgotten the sight of him hitting his head on the bed's frame, the way his body was thrown across the floor, how he'd slumped unnaturally in the corner and made no sound or movement as she'd hauled him beneath the bed. She pried herself away from him. She was covered in sweat, and her hair had tangled around them both, binding them almost as securely as Sybil's knotted sheets had. "Carswell?" she hissed. It was strange to say his name aloud, like she hadn't yet earned the familiarity. She licked her lips, and her voice cracked the second time. "Mr. Thorn?" Her fingers pressed against his throat. Relief. His heartbeat was strong. She hadn't been sure during the fall whether he was breathing. But now, with the world quiet and still, she could make out wheezing air coming from his mouth.
Maybe he had a concussion. Kress had read about people getting concussions when they hit their heads. She couldn't remember what happened to them, but she knew it was bad.
Wake up, please. We're alive. We made it.
She placed a palm on his cheek, surprised to find roughness there. Nothing at all like her own smooth face. Facial hair. It made sense, and yet, somehow, she'd never worked the sensation of prickly facial hair into her fantasies. She would amend that after this. She shook her head, ashamed to be thinking of something like that when Carswell Thorne was hurt right before her. And she couldn't do any... He twitched. Kress gasped and attempted to cushion his head in case he jerked around too much.
Mr. Thorne, wake up. We're all right. Please, wake up.
A low, painful moan, and his breaths began to even out. Kress pushed her hair out of her face. It fought against her, clinging to her sweat-dampened skin. Long strands of it were pinned beneath their bodies. He groaned again.
Carswell?
His elbow lurched, like he was trying to lift his hand, but his wrists were still bound between them. His lashes fluttered.
Huh? It's all right. I'm here. We're safe.
Thorne dragged his tongue around his lips, then shut his eyes again.
Thorne, he grunted. Most people call me Thorne or Captain.
Her heart lifted.
Of course, Captain, are you in pain?
He shifted uncomfortably, discovering that his hands were still tied.
I feel like my brain's about to leak out through my ears, but otherwise I feel great.
Kress inspected the back of his head with her fingers. There was no dampness, so at least he wasn't bleeding.
You hit your head pretty hard.
He grunted and tried to wriggle his hands out of the knotted blanket.
Oh, hold on. There was that knife.
She trailed off, scouring the clutter and debris around them.
It fell off the bed, said Thorne.
Yes, I saw it. There! She spotted the knife handle lodged beneath the fallen screen and went to grab for it. But her hair had gotten so wrapped up around her and Thorne that it yanked her back. She yelped and rubbed at her scalp. He opened his eyes again, frowning.
I don't remember being tied together before.
I'm sorry, my hair gets everywhere sometimes, and... If you could just... Here, roll this way. She grabbed his elbow and nudged him onto his side. With a scowl, he complied, allowing her enough movement to reach the knife handle.
Are you sure it's over?
Thorne started, but she had already draped herself over his side and was sawing through the blanket.
Oh, you have a good memory.
Hmm? She murmured, focused on the sharp blade. It frayed easily, and Thorne sighed with relief as it fell away. He rubbed his wrists, then reached toward his head. When the tangles of Kress's hair tried to hold him back, he tugged harder. Kress yelped and crashed into Thorne's chest. He didn't seem to notice as his fingers found the back of his scalp.
Ow, he muttered.
Yeah, she agreed.
This bump is going to last a while. Here, feel this.
What? He fished around for her hand, then brought it to the back of his head.
I have a huge bump back here. No wonder I have such a headache.
He did indeed have an impressive bump on his scalp, but Kress could think only of the softness of his hair and the way she was practically lying on top of him. She blushed.
Yes, right. You should probably,
She had no idea what he should probably do. Kiss her, she thought. Isn't that what people did after they survived thrilling near-death experiences together? She was sure it wasn't an appropriate suggestion, but this close, it was all she could think about. She yearned to lean in closer, to press her nose into the fabric of his shirt and inhale deeply. But she didn't want him thinking she was odd, or guessing the truth, that this moment, filled with injuries and her destroyed satellite and being separated from his friends, was the most perfect moment of her entire life. His brow creased, and he picked at a lock of hair that had tightened around his bicep.
We need to do something about this hair.
Right, right, she shifted away, her scalp screaming as her hair was trapped beneath them. She started to untangle the strands gently, one by one.
Maybe it would help if we turned on the lights. She paused.
The lights?
Are they voice activated?
If the computer system went down in the fall.
Spades. It must be the middle of the night.
Is there a port screen or something we can turn on at least? Cress cocked her head.
I don't understand.
For the briefest moment, he seemed annoyed.
It would help if we could see.
His eyes were open, but he was looking blankly past Cress's shoulder. He pried away some strands of hair that had gotten twisted around his wrist, then waved his hand in front of his face.
This is the blackest night I've ever seen. We must be somewhere rural. Is it a new moon tonight?
His scowl deepened, and she could tell he was trying to remember where Earth was in its moon cycle.
That doesn't seem right. Must be really overcast.
Captain? It isn't dark. I can see just fine.
He frowned in confusion and, after a moment, worry. His jaw flexed.
Please tell me you're practicing your sarcasm.
My sarcasm? Why would I do that?
Shaking his head, he squeezed his eyes tight together, opened them again, blinked rapidly.
Cursed.
Pressing her lips, Cress held her fingers in front of him, waved them back and forth. There was no reaction.
What happened? He said. The last thing I remember is trying to get under the bed.
You hit your head on the bed frame and I dragged you under here, and then we landed. A little rocky, but that's all. You just hit your head.
And that can cause blindness?
It might be some sort of brain trauma. Maybe it's only temporary. Maybe you're in shock?
He settled his head on the floor. A heavy silence closed around them. Cress chewed on her lip. Finally, he spoke again, and his voice had taken on a determined edge.
We need to do something about this hair. Where did that knife go?
Before she could question the logic behind giving a knife to a blind man, she had set it into his palm. Thorn reached behind her with his other hand and gathered a fistful of her hair. The touch sent a delicious tingle down her spine.
Sorry, but it grows back, he said, not sounding at all apologetic.
He began sawing through the tangles, one handful at a time. Grab, cut, release. Cress held perfectly still, not because she was afraid of being cut. The knife was steady in his hand, despite the blindness, and Thorn kept the blade angled carefully away from her neck. But because it was Thorn. It was Captain Carswell Thorn. Running his hands through her hair, his rough jaw mere inches away from her lips, his brow furrowed in concentration. By the time he was brushing feather-soft fingers along her neck, checking for any strands he'd missed, she was dizzy with euphoria. He found a missed lock of hair by her left ear and cut it away.
I think that's it.
He tucked the knife under his leg so that he would know where to find it and buried his hands into the short, impossibly light hair, working out the remaining tangles. A satisfied grin stretched over his face.
Maybe a little jagged on the ends, but much better.
Cress reached for the back of her neck, amazed at the sensation of bare skin, still damp from sweat, and short, cropped hair that had a subtle wave to it now that all the weight was gone. She scratched her fingernails along her scalp, riveted by the pleasure of such a foreign sensation. It felt as though 20 pounds had been cut from her head. Tightness was fading from muscles that she hadn't even realized was there.
Thank you.
You're welcome, he said, brushing away the locks of hair that still clung to him.
And I'm really sorry about the blindness.
Not your fault.
It is kind of my fault if I hadn't asked you to come rescue me and if I hadn't—
It's not your fault, he said again, his tone cutting off her argument.
You sound like Cinder. She always blames herself for the stupidest things.
The war is her fault. Scarlet's grandmother is her fault. I bet she'd take responsibility for the plague, too, if she could.
Picking up the knife, he shimmied out from beneath the bed, pushing his arms out in a wide circle to nudge away any debris before pulling himself up onto the edge of the mattress. His progress was slow, like he didn't trust himself to move more than a few inches at a time. Cress followed and stood up beside him, shuffling some of the debris around with her bare toes. One hand stayed buried in her hair.
The point is, that witch tried to kill us, but we survived, said Thorn. And we'll find a way to contact the Rampian, and they'll come get us. And we'll be fine.
He said it like he was trying to convince himself, but Cress didn't need any convincing. He was right. They were alive, and they were together. And they would be fine.
I just need a moment to think, said Thorn. Figure out what we're going to do.
Cress nodded and rocked back on her heels. For a long time, Thorn seemed to be deep in thought, his hands clasped in his lap. After a minute, Cress realized they were shaking. Finally, Thorn tilted his head toward her, though his unfocused eyes were on the wall. He took in a deep breath, let it out, then smiled.
Let's begin again, with some proper introductions. Did I hear your name was Crescent?
Just Cress, please.
He extended a hand toward her. When she gave him hers, he tugged her closer, bent his head, and pressed a kiss against her knuckles. Cress stiffened and swooned, her knees threatening to buckle beneath her.
Captain Carswell Thorn, at your service.
Chapter 14. Cinder followed the progression of the Rampian on her retina display, watching breathlessly as they entered Earth's atmosphere over northern Africa and careened toward Farafra, a small oasis that had once been a trading post for caravans traveling between the Central African provinces and the Mediterranean Sea. It had fallen into poverty since the plague had first struck a decade ago, sending the trade caravans farther east. She didn't leave Wolf's side. She dressed the wounds as well as she could using the bandages and ointments the guard had thrown down from the ship's upper level. She had already had to change the bandages once, and still the blood soaked through. His face was pale and clammy, his heartbeat growing weaker, each breath a struggle.
Please, please let Dr. Erland be there.
So far, the guard at least had proven trustworthy. He had flown straight and fast, very fast, to Cinder's relief. It was a risk entering Earth's orbit, but a necessary one. She only hoped this oasis would be the safe haven the doctor had believed it to be.
Cinder, said Aiko, the Lunar is asking where he should land.
She shuddered. She'd been expecting the question. It would be safest and most prudent to land outside the town, out in the ruthless desert. But she could never carry Wolf, and they didn't have the luxury of being prudent. Tell him to land on the main road. On the map, it looks like there's only one, a town square of sorts. And tell him not to worry about being stealthy. If they couldn't hide, then she would draw as much attention as possible. Maybe if they made enough of a spectacle, it would draw Dr. Erland out from wherever he was hiding. She had to hope that any civilians would be so distracted by their brazenness, they wouldn't bother alerting the police until it was too late. It wasn't a good plan, but there wasn't time to come up with anything better. The ship dove. Normally, this was the quiet part of landing, when the engine power switched to magnetic levitation. But it seemed the guard was planning on doing this all manually. Perhaps the town was so rural, they didn't have magnetic roads at all. Finally, the ship clanked and groaned. Though it was a soft landing, the shock still made Cinder jump. Wolf groaned. Cinder bent over him and cupped his face in both hands.
Wolf, I'm going to get help. Just stay with us, all right? Just hold on.
Standing, she keyed in the code for the podship dock. The dock was a sight. Blood and destruction everywhere. But she walked past the remaining shuttle and tried to put it all from her thoughts.
Iko, open hatch.
As soon as the doors had parted enough for her to fit through, she crouched on the ledge and jumped down into the street. A cloud of dust whirled around her as her feet struck the hard, dry ground. The surrounding buildings were mostly single-story structures made of stone or clay, or large beige bricks. Some window shutters had been painted blue or pink, and stenciled designs lined the entryways. But the colors had been bleached by the sun and chipped by relentless sand. The road dipped down toward an oasis lake a few blocks to Cinder's right, both sides lined with thriving palm trees. Trees that looked too alive for a town that hung with desertion. A few blocks to her left was a stone wall lined with more trees, and beyond it, reddish plateaus disappearing in a sandy haze. People were emerging from the buildings and around street corners, civilians of all ages, mostly dressed in shorts and lightweight tops to combat the desert heat, though a few more wore more concealing robes to keep off the blazing sun. Many were covering their mouths and noses. At first, Cinder thought they were protecting themselves from the plague, but then she realized they were simply annoyed at how much dust the ship's landing had kicked up. The cloud was already blowing off down one of the side streets. Cinder scanned them, searching for a wrinkled face and a familiar gray cap. Dr. Erland would be paler than most of the townspeople, although skin tones ranged from the deepest browns to honeyed tans. Still, she suspected that a little old man with glaringly blue eyes would have drawn some attention in the past weeks. She opened her hands wide to show she had no weapons and took a step toward the crowd. Her cyborg hand was on full display, and the townsfolk had noticed. They were staring at it openly, though no one shied away as she took another step closer.
"I'm sorry about the dust," she said, gesturing to the cloud. "But this is an emergency. I need to find someone, a man, this tall, old, wears glasses and a hat. Have any of you—" "I saw her first," a girl squealed.
She ran out from the crowd, her flip-flops smacking the dirt, and grasped Cinder's arm. Startled, Cinder tried to pull away, but the girl held firm. Then there were two boys, not older than 9 or 10, emerging from the crowd and arguing over who had seen the ship drop out of the sky, who had seen it land, who had seen the docks open, and who had first spotted the cyborg.
"Step away from Miss Lin, you greedy little vultures."
Cinder whirled around. Dr. Erland was striding toward them, though she almost didn't recognize him. Barefoot and hatless, he wore a pair of khaki shorts and a striped shirt that hung lopsided, as he'd missed a buttonhole and the rest of the buttons were all wrong. His gray hair stuck out along his bald spot like he'd recently been electrocuted. None of that mattered. She'd found him.
"I suppose you can all share the prize for finding her, even though the deal was to bring her to me, not to make me come all the way down here in the center of the sun heat."
He pulled a bag of gummy candies from his pocket and held it up over the children's heads, forcing them to promise to share before he handed it over. They snatched it and ran away, squealing. The rest of the townspeople remained where they were. Dr. Erland planted his hands on his hips and glared up at Cinder.
"You have much explaining to do. Do you know how long I've been waiting for you, watching the—"
"I need your help," she said, stumbling toward him. "My friend, he's dying. He needs a doctor. I don't know what to do."
He scowled, then his attention caught on something over Cinder's shoulder. The Lunar Guard emerged at the edge of the ship, shirtless and covered in blood, and straining to support Wolf's body.
"What? He's—"
"A Lunar Guard," said Cinder. "And Wolf is one of her soldiers. It's a long story, and I'll explain it later, but can you help him?"
He was shot twice. He's lost a lot of blood. Dr. Erland raised an eyebrow.
Cinder could tell he wasn't at all thrilled with the company she was keeping.
Please.
Harumphing, he gestured at some of the onlookers and called out a few names. Three men stepped forward.
Bring him to the hotel, he said. Gently.
With a sigh, he set about redoing the buttons on his shirt.
Follow me, Miss Lin. You can help prepare the tools.
Chapter 15. I suppose it's too much to hope that we landed ourselves near any sort of civilization, Thorn said, tilting his head to one side.
Cress picked her way through the debris to the nearest window. I'm not sure we want to be near civilization. You're a wanted criminal in three earthen countries, and one of the most recognizable men on Earth.
I am pretty famous now, aren't I? Grinning, he waved a hand at her. I guess it doesn't matter what we want. What do you see out there?
Standing on tiptoes, Cress peered into the brightness. As her eyes adjusted to the glare, they widened, trying to take it all in. All at once, it dawned on her. She was on Earth. On Earth. She'd seen pictures, of course, thousands and thousands of photographs and vids, cities and lakes and forests and mountains, every landscape imaginable. But she had never thought the sky could be so impossibly blue, or that the land could hold so many hues of gold, or could glitter like a sea of diamonds, or could roll and swell like a breathing creature. For one moment, the reality of it all poured into her body and overflowed.
Cress?
It's beautiful out there.
A hesitation before. Could you be more specific?
The sky is this gorgeous, intense blue color? She pressed her fingers to the glass and traced the wavy hills on the horizon.
Oh, good. You've really narrowed it down for me.
I'm sorry, it's just...
She tried to stamp down the rush of emotion.
I think we're in a desert.
Cactuses and tumbleweeds?
No, just a lot of sand. It's kind of orangish gold with hints of pink, and I can see tiny clouds of it floating above the ground like smoke.
Piled up in lots of hills?
Yes, exactly. And it's beautiful.
Thorn snorted. If this is how you feel about a desert, I can't wait until you see your first real tree. Your mind will explode.
She beamed out at the world. Trees.
That explains the heat, then, Thorn said. Cress, in her thin cotton dress, hadn't noticed before. But the temperature did seem to be rising. The controls must have been reset in the fall. Or perhaps destroyed altogether. A desert would not have been my first choice. Do you see anything useful? Palm trees? Watering holes? A pair of camels out for a stroll?
She looked again, noting how a pattern of ripples had been carved into the landscape, repeating for eternity. No, there's nothing else.
All right. Here's what I need you to do. Thorn ticked off on his fingers. First, find some way to contact the Rampian. The sooner we get back on my ship, the better. Second, let's see if we can get that door open. We're going to be baked alive if the temperature keeps rising like this.
Cress studied the mess of screens and cords on the floor. The satellite was never installed with external communication abilities. The only chance we had of contacting your crew was the DCOM chip that Sybil took. And even if we did have some way of contacting them, we won't be able to give exact coordinates unless the satellite positioning system is functioning, and even then...
Thorn held up a hand. One thing at a time. We have to let them know that we're not dead. And check that they're all right, too. I think they're capable of handling two measly lunars, but it would put my mind at ease to be sure. He shrugged. Once they know to start looking for us, maybe Cinder can whip up a giant metal detector or something.
Cress scanned the wreckage. I'm not sure anything is salvageable.
The screens are all destroyed, and, judging from the loss of temperature regulation, the generator is... Oh no! Little Cress!
She wailed and kicked her way to the main data board that had housed her younger self. It was crushed on one side, bits of wire and plastic dangling from the shell.
Oh, Little Cress!
Who's Little Cress? She sniffed.
Me, when I was 10. She lived in the computer and kept me company, and now... She's dead.
She squeezed the data board against her chest.
Poor, sweet little Cress.
After a long silence, Thorn cleared his throat. Scarlet did warn me about this. Do we need to bury little Cress before we can move on? Want me to say a few words for her? Cress glanced up, and though his expression was sympathetic, she thought he was probably mocking her.
I'm not crazy. I know she's just a computer. It's just, I programmed her myself, and she was the only friend I had. That's all.
Hey, I'm not judging. I'm familiar with IT relations. Just wait until you meet our spaceship. She's a riot.
His expression became thoughtful.
Speaking of spaceships, what about that other pod, the one the guard docked with?
Oh, I'd forgotten about that.
She tucked the data board beneath its slanted desk and tripped over to the other entryway. The satellite sat at an angle, with the second entry near the lower end of the slope, and she had to clear away countless bits of plastic and broken equipment before she could get to the control screen. The screen itself was down. She couldn't get a flicker of power out of it. So she opened the panel that housed the manual override locks instead. A series of gears and handles had been set into the wall over the door, and while Cress had known they were there for years, she'd never given them much thought before. The devices were stuck from years of neglect, and it took all her strength to pull on the handle, planting one foot on the wall to gain leverage. Finally, it snapped down and the doors sprang open, leaving a gap. Hearing her struggle, Thorn got up and trudged toward her, carefully kicking debris out of his way. He kept his hands outstretched until he bumped into her, and together they pried open the door. The docking hatch was in worse shape than the satellite. Almost an entire wall had been sheared off, and piles of sand had already begun to blow in between the cracks. Wires and clamps dangled from the shattered wall panels, and Cress could smell smoke and the bitter scent of burned plastic. The podship had been shoved up into the corridor, crumpling the far end of the hatch like an accordion. The docking clamp had been rammed straight through the ship's cockpit control panel, filling the glass with hairline fractures. Please tell me it looks better than it smells, said Thorn, hanging on to the doorframe.
Not really. The ship is destroyed, and it looks like all the instruments, too.
Cress climbed down, holding onto the wall for balance. She tried pressing some buttons to bring the ship back to life, but it was useless. All right, next plan. Thorn rubbed his eyes. We have no way of contacting the Rampian, and they have no way of knowing we're alive. Probably won't do us much good to stay here and hope someone passes by. We're going to have to try and find some sort of civilization. She wrapped her arms around herself, a mix of nerves and giddiness swirling in her stomach.
She was going to leave the satellite. It looked like the sun was setting, she said, so at least we won't be walking in the heat.
Thorn screwed up his lips and thought. This time of year, the nights shouldn't be too cold, no matter which hemisphere we've landed in. We need to gather up all the supplies we can carry. Do you have any more blankets? And you'll want a jacket.
Cress rubbed her palms down the thin dress. I don't have a jacket. I've never needed one.
Thorn sighed. Figures.
I do have another dress that isn't quite so worn as this one.
Pants would be better.
She glanced down at her bare legs. She'd never worn pants before. These dresses are all Sybil brought me. I don't have any shoes either.
No shoes? Thorn massaged his brow. All right, fine. I went through survival training in the military. I can figure this out.
I do have a few bottles we can fill with water, and plenty of food packs.
It's a start. Water is our first priority. Dehydration will be a much bigger threat than hunger. Do you have any towels?
A couple.
Good. Bring those, and something we can use for rope. He raised his left foot. While you're at it, do you have any idea where my other boot ended up?
Are you sure you don't want me to do that?
Thorn scowled, his empty gaze pinned somewhere around her knee. I may be temporarily blind, but I'm not useless. I can still tie good knots.
Cress scratched at her ear and withheld further comment. She was seated on the edge of her bed, braiding a discarded lock of her own hair to use for rope, while Thorn knelt before her. His face was set in concentration as he wrapped a towel around her foot, then looped the rope around her ankle and the arch of her foot a few times before securing it with an elaborate knot.
You want them to be nice and tight. If the fabric's too loose, it will rub and give you blisters. How does that feel?
She wiggled her toes. Good, she said, and waited until Thorn had finished the other foot before surreptitiously adjusting the folds of the cloth to be more comfortable. When she stood, it felt strange, like walking on lumpy pillows, but Thorn seemed to think she'd be grateful for the makeshift shoes when they were out in the desert. Together, they fashioned a bundle out of a blanket, which they filled with water, food, bedsheets, and a small medical kit that Cress had rarely needed. The knife was safely in Thorn's boot, and they disassembled part of the busted bed frame for Thorn to use as a walking cane. They each drank as much water as they could stand, and then, as Cress gave one last inspection of the satellite and could think of nothing else worth taking, she stepped to the docking hatch and pulled down the manual unlock lever. With a ka-thunk, the door's internal devices released. The hydraulics hissed. A crack opened between the metal doors, allowing Thorn to get his fingers in and push one side into its wall pocket. A breeze of dry air blew into the satellite, a scent Cress had no comparison for. It was nothing like the satellite, or the machinery, or Sybil's perfume. Earth, she supposed, memorizing the aroma. Or desert. Thorn swung the makeshift supply bundle over his shoulder. Kicking some debris out of the way, he reached his hand toward Cress.
Lead the way.
His hand encased hers, and she wanted to savor the moment, the sensation of touch and warmth and this perfect smell of freedom. But Thorn was nudging her forward before the moment had settled. At the end of the docking hatch was the rail and two steps leading down to where a pod ship normally attached. But now, there was only sand. Tinted lavender as night's shadows crept forward. It had already started to blow up onto the second step, and Cress had a vision of the satellite being slowly buried beneath it, disappearing forever in the desert. And then she looked out, past the railing and the dunes, toward the rolling horizon. The sky was a haze of violet, and where that faded away, blue and black and stars. The same stars she'd known all her life, and yet now they were spread out like a blanket over her. Now there was an entire sky and an entire world ready to engulf her. Her head swam. Suddenly dizzy, Cress stumbled backward, crashing into Thorn.
What? What is it?
She tried to swallow down the rising panic. This sensation that her existence was as small and unimportant as the tiniest fleck of sand blowing against her shins. There was a whole world, a whole planet, and she was stuck somewhere in the middle of it, away from everything. There were no walls, no boundaries, nothing to hide behind. A shudder swept over her, goosebumps crawling across her bare arms.
Cress, what happened? What do you see?
Thorn's fingers tightened on her arms, and she realized she was trembling.
She stammered twice before forcing the thought out of her head.
It's so big.
What's so big?
Everything. Earth, the sky. It didn't seem so big from space.
Her pulse was a drum, thundering through every artery. She could hardly take in any air, and she had to cover her face and turn away before she could breathe again. Even then, the sensation was painful. Suddenly, she was crying, without knowing when the tears had started. Thorne's hand found her elbows, tender and gentle. There was a moment in which she expected to be taken into his arms, pressed warm and safe against his chest. She yearned for it. But instead, he shook her, hard.
Stop it! Cress hiccuped. What is the number one thing people die from in the desert?
She blinked, and another hot tear slipped down her cheek.
What?
The number one cause of deaths. What is it?
Dehydration, she said, recalling the Survival 101 lecture he'd given while filling up their water bottles.
And what does crying do?
It took a moment.
Dehydrates?
Exactly. His grip relaxed. It's all right to be scared. I get that until now, most of your existence has been contained in 200 square meters. In fact, so far, you've shown yourself to be saner than I expected. She sniffed, unsure if he'd just complimented or insulted her.
But I need you to pull yourself together. You may have noticed that I'm not exactly in prime form right now, and I'm relying on you to be aware and observant and help us find our way out of this, because if we don't, I don't know about you, but I'm just not fond of the idea of being stranded out here and eaten alive by vultures.
So, can I depend on you to hold it together for both of us?
Yes,
she whispered, though her chest was about to burst with all the doubts being crammed into it. Thorne squinted, and she didn't think he believed her.
I'm not convinced that you fully grasp the situation here, Cress. We will be eaten. Alive. By vultures. Can you visualize that for a second?
Yes. Vultures. I understand.
Good. Because I need you. And those are not words that I throw around every day. Now, are you going to be all right?
Yes. Just give me... I just need a moment.
This time, she took in an extra deep breath and shut her eyes and grappled for a daydream. Any daydream.
I am an explorer, she whispered, setting courageously off into the wild unknown.
It was not a daydream she'd ever had before, but she'd felt the familiar comfort of her imagination wrapping around her. She was an archaeologist, a scientist, a treasure hunter. She was a master of land and sea.
My life is an adventure, she said, growing confident as she opened her eyes again. I will not be shackled to this satellite anymore.
Thorne tilted his head to one side. He waited for three heartbeats before sliding one hand down into hers.
I have no idea what you're talking about, he said, but we'll go with it.
Chapter 16. Thorne passed the makeshift cane to his opposite side so he could hold Cress's elbow as they stepped out onto the sand. She kept her head down, carefully choosing each step, but also afraid that if she looked up into the sky, her legs would freeze beneath her and she would never be able to make them move again. When they'd gone a safe distance from the satellite, Cress tentatively lifted her gaze. Ahead of her was the same eternal landscape, the sky growing darker. She glanced back toward the satellite and gasped. Thorne's hand squeezed her elbow.
There are mountains, she said, gaping at the jagged peaks along the horizon.
He squinted. Mountains or glorified hills?
She considered the question, comparing the sight before her with the photos of mountain ranges she'd seen on the screens. Dozens of peaks of varying heights disappeared into the